From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
Beat the clock, beat the clock. Beat the clock, beat the clock. Digital technologies really don't understand time. They live outside time. They're just sequences. You know, your Twitter feed is not in real time. It's just trying to catch up with you. Just because people are sending emails out to you, it doesn't mean that now you have to respond in real time to them, right? The beauty of digital technology was that it waited.
Initially, you get some incredibly sweet candy that incites you to enter into the system and give over information to other people.
I want candy. I want candy. Hey! Hey!
How is the internet changing our lives? Today, we'll talk with Douglas Rushkoff, who says we're living in an era of present shock, in which everything happens now. Gabriella Coleman takes us inside the world of hackers. And author James Lasden tells us how one of his former students turned into a verbal terrorist and made his life a living hell. But first, visionary computer scientist Jaron Lanier. He's best known for his research on virtual reality. He has a new book out called Who Owns the Future? Anne Strainchamps talks with Jaron Lanier.
Well, Jaron, in your book, you argue that the rise of digital networks, you know, like Facebook and Google, has led our economy into recession and decimated the middle class, which most of us who use Facebook and Google probably think, how can that be? What kind of financial implications could using Facebook have?
Yes. Well, here's the issue. The issue is that we've adopted a business model for using information technology where by far the best way to make money is to have the biggest computer on the network in some remote server farm that builds behavioral models of other people and then uses those behavioral models to subtly manipulate those people. And the problem with that business model is that it works so well that it concentrates wealth and power in an incredibly exclusive club of the people who own the biggest computers.
Wow, you're describing 1984.
Well, you know, it's not exactly 1984 because 1984 was all gray and drab. And in truth, most of the people who own the biggest computers are kind of young and hip and cool and nice. And they really are. I mean, we have the sweetest elite in history probably, but it doesn't matter. The point is that we're concentrating wealth and power so intensely that it's undoing our security and our futures. And I have to point out that the architecture has had its worst effects so far, not in things like social media and search and whatnot, but in finance. But the thing is, if you look at the big hedge funds and high-frequency trading firms and all these concerns, it's the same type of computer, the same algorithms, the same architectures, the same kinds of people, the same kinds of strategy. You know, if you just change the labels, we're looking at the same thing. It's just a way of using information to concentrate power. And so the way it happens is that initially you get some incredibly sweet candy that incites you to enter into the system and give over information to other people. And in finance, it might be a too-good-to-believe mortgage or something like that, or recently maybe bitcoins. But anyway, whatever it is, it's some kind of candy. And then in the case of consumer internet stuff, it's like free services, free social networking or whatever. And then what happens is you start giving over your information to these parties who use it to calculate wealth out of the world. And they are so good at it that they actually undermine the world in which their wealth even makes sense. And that's called too big to fail.
Play this out in more consumer-oriented terms. For instance, you point out this sort of astonishing discrepancy when we used to have big companies like Kodak versus little tiny companies that may be worth more but are, you know, have tiny numbers of employees.
Right. So what's happened now is that we've taken what used to be really huge industries in terms of middle class jobs like music and photography and this thing you might have heard of called journalism. And
Never heard of that.
And what's happened is we've replaced an old system in which there were many hundreds of thousands of solid middle-class jobs with security and the potential for retirement and a safety cushion and all of those good things. And we've replaced them with a system in which there's early treats. There's a really easier on-ramp and this illusion of sort of equity and access for everybody. Well, it's more than an illusion. The early treats can sometimes be very real. But the problem with it is that there's only a token number of success stories, a tiny token number of people who have successful YouTube videos or something like that. And everyone else lives on hope. It's a revival of the old Horatio Alger stories from the 19th century. And this economy of most people sort of scrambling for hope with a tiny number of token winners of sort of princes or the very special unusual people instead of a real middle class is no way to run a civilization. You know, you can't have a democracy that way. A democracy totally relies on people broadly being able to outspend the tip of elites, you know, and we lose that in that world. And it's only starting. I mean, the really big thing happens when the cars are driving themselves and robots are operating the factories or objects are being printed out for us by 3D printers. As the century progresses in a couple decades from now, perhaps, we're going to start to lose a lot of middle-class jobs. And the thing about that is that all that stuff still runs on information. Somebody's going to design the objects that are printed out by 3D printers. But if we keep on doing things the way we are, all the money's going to accrue to whatever big computer is routing the information, and only tiny token number of people will actually benefit from the system themselves, and everyone else will live on hope. And that leads us to nowhere. It leads us to a failed economy.
Mm. It sounds like the underlying issue is that we've created a world in which humans seem to be becoming less and less useful. Machines are increasingly better at creating value than people are. And yet, what you're pointing out is that that's an illusion. Of course they're not. We've just created this kind of giant shell game in which we're not valuing the human part of the input.
Exactly. That's precisely what's going on. We're creating a theatrical illusion in which we're pretending that value isn't coming from people in order to support the fantasy of artificial intelligence on a network doing work, which is not real at all. But what it does do is it concentrates huge fortunes with the people who own this illusion.
Right. Well, you've proposed that we, as part of beginning to craft a solution, something you call a humanistic information economy. What is that?
Well, this goes back to the very origin of the whole idea of connecting people on a digital network. What's interesting is that the very first generation of ideas were exactly what I'm proposing. So I'm not really proposing something radically new, but in a way going back to where we started. So back in 1960, the first ideas about how to connect people on digital networks were articulated, and the fellow who did it was named Ted Nelson. He's actually still with us, and he's still named Ted Nelson. And Ted's idea is simple. His parents were Hollywood parents, and he'd seen directly how the labor movement had created a possibility for actors and musicians in Hollywood to find some sense of security, even in a business that was very kind of chancy and where you lived gig to gig. And he realized that someday, as automation got really good and machines got better and better, we'd move into an information economy, and everybody would be living a life that's kind of like what a Hollywood actor or musician was living, and everybody would need the same kinds of benefits. Everybody who's a truck driver now, or a miner, or a teacher, or a doctor, or a nurse, or anybody at all was going to be in the same boat. And he saw that there was a kind of simple solution, actually. And the solution is to always keep track of where information comes from on a network. And if you have a link back to whoever was the source of information that's useful later, you can send them a micropayment. And if you have a universal micropayment system in a richly, densely connected network, you would naturally create a middle class out of an information economy that would be persistent. And then you could afford to have a democracy because the middle class could always outspend the elite and so forth. So it would create a solution that would finally get us beyond the fear of automation killing jobs.
Well, wait, does this mean that to open a link a friend puts on Facebook, I'd have to pay her?
Well, right. And the key thing to remember is that you're also getting paid. I mean, the whole thing about capitalism is that you have to kind of go on faith that even though you have to pay for stuff, you're also getting paid for your stuff. And by having economic activity, the overall value of the society is going up. So on average, people are doing better than they otherwise would.
So the goal would be to post more stuff than you read.
No, not exactly. Here's the way I see it working out. The way the world is currently working now is all of us are being scrutinized constantly by algorithms and remote big computers. They're behavioral models of all of us, and third parties are paying to use those models to manipulate us. They manipulate what links you see on Google and who you're introduced to on Facebook and all kinds of stuff like that. And the idea is to sort of gradually create this perfect investment where you can just pay to manipulate the world to your benefit. Now, the thing is that all of that value that we're providing is very real. So if we just kept track of whenever there are bits that exist because of you, even if you didn't intend to create them, and that would create a micropayment, you'd constantly be earning little dribs and drabs of money. It's not necessarily a conscious thing.
Whoa, do you mean that if I'm like browsing the new books at Amazon, and of course Amazon keeps track of what books I look at, later I'm going to get a little check in the mail from Amazon?
If and only if that data contributes to Amazon being able to increase its profits by using that data in some way. Yeah, absolutely. And I know this might sound like sort of an alien or weird scheme to people, but the thing you have to understand is that the complexity of it is actually less than what we're doing now. People don't understand how insane what we're doing now is. And the notion that keeping track of where value comes from will actually lead to betterment for people is just the same old weird trick of capitalism, which does actually work. So it's just a combination of using network design and capitalism together more efficiently than what we're currently doing. And I know it sounds sort of alien and weird, but it actually does make sense. You know, in a funny way, it's exactly what's implemented within the confines of somebody's private networking space. Like when you go on Facebook, you can keep track of who's linked to you. It's a full network. If Facebook was monetized, it would actually generate a ton of money. And that would actually be good for people and good for Facebook. It would actually make Facebook a richer company.
So play this out a bit, because I want to make sure I understand it. How would this work in practice if I'm going online and I'm using, I don't know, Pinterest or Facebook, or I'm ordering some music on iTunes? What would change?
Well, what would change is if you're on Pinterest, first of all, if you get a lot of attention in Pinterest, you get direct money from that. But more importantly, if some fund somewhere is analyzing what you do on Pinterest and they realize that they should change their investment in real estate in your neighborhood based on behavioral models of people in your neighborhood, based on how people in your neighborhood are looking at your Pinterest information, the way this happens is all very indirect and very weird and algorithmic and doesn't necessarily even make sense to the human mind. But whatever it is, there'd be links back to where the information came from. And if the result of an algorithm created a profit, there would be a backscattering of micropayments to all the sources of the information.
Can you really see this happening without revolution in the streets or laws imposed? I mean, corporations are not, you know, just going to be really happy to start handing back micropayments to millions of people.
Well, I put the question exactly in reverse. I see this as a way of avoiding revolution in the streets, because what I'm worried about is money and power being so concentrated, not immediately, but maybe in like 20 or 30 years, if this pattern persists, that there'll be massive unemployment and massive concentrations of wealth. And then there will be a revolution of just the kind that is extremely unpleasant. And I very much want to avoid that. I actually think what I'm saying is good for ordinary people, but it's also good for corporations. I mean, the thing about corporations and finance schemes and any activity in capitalism is that it's only valuable to the degree in overall society is wealthy and an economy is growing, in fact, and they all feed off of general well-being. And if we're undoing that, we're actually undercutting these very institutions that are propagating it. And I think ultimately they'll see that it's in their own self-interest.
Jaron Lanier is the author of Who Owns the Future? He spoke with Anne Strainchamps. So what do you think of Lanier's argument? You can let us know by sending us a message through Facebook or Twitter, or through our website at ttbook.org, where you will find links to our Facebook and Twitter accounts. You ever feel overwhelmed by all the digital technology that's entered our lives? Feel pressure to keep up with your email and Facebook posts? You're not alone. Media theorist Douglas Rushkoff says this technology has changed our relationship to time, and we're having trouble adapting to it. Steve Paulson talks with Rushkoff about his new book, Present Shock: When Everything Happens Now.
Doug, the title of your book, Present Shock, is a reference to Alvin Toffler's 1970 book, Future Shock. What's the difference between future shock and present shock?
Well, I guess in some sense, maybe the sensation might be similar. The real difference is that the future that Alvin Toffler was describing that we were moving towards is here with us now. So while Toffler was really warning us really to learn how to orient to a world that was changing ever more rapidly, to basically be able to adjust to change itself, I'm arguing that that change has happened, that if anything, you know, as we passed from the 90s into the 21st century, we became less of a society that was just obsessed with the future and what's next and what's happening, what's the next big thing, where is it all going? And we became a society that was very much in the moment, in a kind of an always-on, real-time, hyper-connected moment. So our focus really becomes less about how do we adjust to change to something much more like how do we adjust to living in a world where everything is happening seemingly at the same time.
Hmm. Well, you break this idea of presentism down into five big areas, and let's talk about those. One you call digiphrenia. What is this?
Well, digiphrenia is interesting, and it kind of comes out of that video game sensibility. I mean, the beauty of video games is that instead of watching some other character go through a story, you're the one going through the story. You know, you're the one making the choices in real time, and you move from choice to choice to choice to choice rather than watching these canned choices. It's the sense of agency. But, you know, the digital environment very often makes it seem like you don't even have to choose. You don't have to choose between this and that. You can choose both. And we're doing so many things online where we're choosing both that we've ended up with really multiple instances, multiple incarnations of ourselves kind of running simultaneously on all these different platforms. And it's very hard to live with more than one you. You know, digital technology is great for copying things, but human beings don't copy so well. So there's you on Twitter that maybe somebody's commenting on something that you did. There's you in your inbox that's filling up with messages that are waiting for responses. There's you on Facebook who might be being used to advertise a product you never even heard of while you're asleep, you know, and you'll wake up that you've been in these sponsored stories. You know, so how do you deal with all of these different yous running simultaneously? That's sort of the essence of this digiphrenia or this kind of digital confusion.
So you're basically saying that it's enough to make you a little crazy. There's almost like a split personality here because we're tending to so many different digital personae.
Right. And even if your personality is not split, your digital personalities are split and your single personality is going to have to deal with all of them. I got the idea for the digiphrenia chapter when I was in the lobby of a hotel in Berlin. I kept trying to log into my Google Calendar to see if I could do one talk at the same time as another talk, whether I'd be able to get from one to the other in time. And each place I went, I couldn't log in until I finally got Wi-Fi and I'm in this lobby. And I get this message back from Google that they locked me out of my calendar because they said I was trying to log in from too many places at once, right? So Google Calendar didn't believe I was a human being. They didn't believe one human could be in all those places at once. And that, to me, seemed to be the essence of, you know, the problem we have with digital culture. It's not this idea of information overload, and all these people have all these problems with digital technology. And this, I promise you, Present Shock is not one of these books. It's just whining and hand-wringing about the problems of digitality. But what I do get concerned about is our readiness to really to put our human lives into digital timeframes. You know, digital technologies really don't understand time. They live outside time. They're just sequences. You know, your Twitter feed is not in real time. It's just trying to catch up with you. Just because people are sending emails out to you, it doesn't mean that now you have to respond in real time to them, right? The beauty of digital technology was that it waited. You know, the early conversations we used to have on the bulletin boards, we were all so smart because we had all the time in the world to respond to these things. We sounded smarter online than we did in real life.
Right. Well, and the irony, of course, is that this was supposed to make our life better. It was supposed to make it easier, and it seems like it's just made us feel crazier.
Right. And that's because, and I mean, and not to get leftist on you or anything, but I really do believe it's because instead of using digital technology kind of for slack, which is what we saw it as, right? We're all going to be able to work from home in our underwear anytime we want, you know, because we'll just get our work done and turn it in as it's ready, rather than going to work for this 8 hours a day and being always on while you're there. What we ended up doing instead was kind of taking the time is money efficiency values of the industrial age and translating them onto the digital age, where digital technology really, if we're going to embrace it the way I think we can, it's about really liberating ourselves from these obsolete industrial age priorities and embracing a totally different really way of working in a much more peer-to-peer fashion where we create value and sell it directly to one another rather than going in and having these sort of 9-to-5 jobs that are really just a relic of the first factories of the 1300s.
Now, another aspect of this presentism that we've been talking about is what you call overwinding. What do you mean by overwinding?
Yeah, it's funny. I got the idea for overwinding when I was rereading Stuart Brand's great book, The Clock of the Long Now, in order to write this one. What he argues in there is that we need to think in these great sort of 10,000-year time spans.
And this is sort of following up on an actual clock that is being built or maybe has been built that will last 10,000 years.
Right. I'll be interested to see if they actually finish the actual clock. I guess there's enough money that went into it. You know, to me, it was just as valuable as a thought experiment, really. What would it be like to build this thing? What would it mean? The most important thing is that now people, he wants us to think in these 10,000-year spans rather than just, you know, next year or even next century. What is the impact of this over 10,000 years? And I was trying to do that, you know, and I had this plastic water bottle. I was about to get on a plane. I didn't see a recycle bin. There was just a trash can there. And I'm like, do I just throw it out? You know, is it going to be 10,000 years? And I realized it wasn't feeling like a long now to me. It was feeling more like a short forever. And that's where I got the idea of overwinding, where in a presentist society and an always-on sort of micro-moment managed society, it's very tempting to try to compress these really long timescales into really short periods of time. So you'll see examples of that, say, you know, on the stock market, where people don't buy in order to invest in the future of a company, they buy in order to make money on the trade, right? So people buy Facebook in the morning and they're mad 5 minutes later that it hasn't gone up and they go sell it. And people who aren't satisfied with that, you know, they end up buying derivatives on stocks, which are really just a way to buy the future stock now, or you buy a derivative on the derivative.
So are there solutions here? I mean, one of the things that you talk about is what you call spring loading. What's that?
Well, spring loading would be a positive way of looking at winding, saying, okay, we can do time compression, but let's do it consciously and willfully rather than just as a way of trying to beat the clock. Or let's at least apply it to areas where timing is necessary. So there's a hospital, you know, that's a hospital in Israel. They wanted to be able to sort of have a hospital in a box that you could just pop on a soccer field somewhere and it would just kind of expand. So what they do is they take a whole lot of time and they put into preparation, you know, okay, what if we're going to have an OBGYN clinic and we're going to have a disease thing and a virus control and something for refugees and starvation? You know, they work out the whole thing and they actually do pop it into these crates and stick it on a cargo plane and they sit and wait. And when the Haiti earthquake happened and when the Japanese tsunami happened, Israel sent over this plane. They popped this thing out on parachutes and the doctors and nurses land on a different plane. And in hours, they have a giant working hospital. You know, the hospital they put in Haiti was better than any local Haiti hospital. And they just dealt with such high volumes of people. And that's really just this sort of a positive way of looking at time, how you can compress something and then explode it out.
Well, it raises questions, fascinating questions about what we mean by real time.
Mm-hmm.
There was a traditional sense of real time of, you know, it was kind of what we would do with our physical body, you know, not dealing with any kind of digital technologies. And yet real time has taken on an entirely different meaning now.
Oh, it has. Real time means this sort of always on Twitter feed. Oh, that's real time. And of course, that's not real time. That's 5 minutes ago, 10 minutes ago, 10 seconds ago. It's still not you in real time. The Greeks actually understood this way back when, even with the sundial or whatever they had two different words for time. You know, there's the typical one, chronos, which means time of the clock, like it's 401. And they had this other word, kairos, which meant timing. And timing was more about your readiness or the appropriateness. Timing was what only humans could really understand. It's like, you know, I crashed the car at 401, but what's the best time to tell Dad that I crashed the car? You know, is that 501? No, it's timing. You know, that's after he's had his drink and before he's opened the bills, right? It's much more subtle. And that more and more time you spend aware of timing and being ready, the more you begin to connect with all of these cycles that, you know, you could call them new age, but they're actually real. I mean, when you ask me how I work according to the moon. You know, I became aware of Irving Dardik, this Olympic trainer who was getting all these great results by sort of matching people's workout routines to lunar cycles. Looking at different weeks of different tides, and it also affects your body's chemistry differently.
Wait, so how do you do this? You work according to the lunar cycle?
Yeah, believe it or not, because what new research is showing, I mean, you can see it in the book or go to, there's a bunch of places like somaspace.org is a great place to look at this stuff, or go to Irving Dardik's Superwave site. So this is edge science, if you will. So it's the kind of thing that, you know, you do a little experimentation on yourself and just see what works and what doesn't. What I found out from them was that over a 28-day lunar cycle, there's sort of four main weeks. 28 days is 4 7-day weeks. And in each week, a different neurotransmitter seems to dominate our brain chemistry. The first week is acetylcholine. The second week is serotonin. Third week is dopamine. And the last week is norepinephrine. So if you know that, you go, oh my gosh, it's not just me, but everybody's on acetylcholine this week. That means they're going to have good energy, right? They're going to be peppy. It's going to be great for introducing them to new ideas. Serotonin week, everybody's going to have a lot of energy to work. You know, everybody's going to be very productive. So that's when I do my writing. I don't even worry about it the next week. Dopamine week, you're not going to get anything done dopamine week. That's when you're going to go skiing and party and go nuts, right? And the final week, norepinephrine, that's the fight or flight neurotransmitter. So that's putting everybody in a very sort of analytic, structural, sort of Barack Obama mindset. You know, that's where to organize my calendar. That's when to organize the chapters of my book. So when I did that, I stopped thinking of dopamine week, which did turn out to come up every month, as writer's block. That's not what it is. It's something else. This is the time when I'm going to enjoy people and have my parties and do my crazy stuff. You know, and then when I looked at it that way, you know, and I just did it by my efficiency in terms of words, my word count went up about 40%.
Really?
Yeah, when I worked really according to these sort of underlying biological clocks. And this stuff, which we look at as folklore now, you got to remember, we looked at jet lag as folklore and old wives' tales until it was Major League Baseball managers started to realize their pitchers did way better when they traveled from the East Coast to the West than when they traveled from the West Coast to the East. And it didn't make sense until they really came to understand how biological clocks work, our relationship to our melatonin in the sun. And there's all of these other cycles. That's what keeps people alive and in time. You know, and when we ride roughshod over it, either with, you know, shift work, trying to be always on, trying to have the same responses in the second week of a cycle as the third or the fourth, that we're always the same. I mean, you can push over it if you're a professional. You can do your show every day. But if you become aware of it, you can realize, oh, my shows this week are going to be more like this and my shows that week are going to be more like that. You can really schedule, you know, your sort of intellectually challenging ones.
You're giving me whole new ideas on how to produce radio here.
It's true. And then put the music stars and those folks on dopamine week, you know, and you can play a tune and do all that. It really does work.
Douglas Rushkoff is the author of Present Shock, When Everything Happens Now. He spoke with Steve Paulson. You feel like you're living in present shock? Perhaps we should start an online support group called Digifrenics Anonymous. Or maybe that would only make things worse. Anyway, we'd love to hear from you. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. You'll also find links to our Facebook and Twitter accounts there. Coming up, we'll go inside the community of computer hackers as we continue our hour on how the Internet is changing our lives. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. computer hackers have taken on a kind of mythic aura. But how much do we really know about them? Gabriella Coleman can help us with this. She's the Wolf Chair in Scientific and Technological Literacy at McGill University in Montreal. Coleman's also an anthropologist and the author of a book called Coding Freedom: The Ethics and Aesthetics of Hacking.
A hacker. When you say the name, invariably, I think a couple of images of kind of criminal breaking into a computer immediately comes to mind. But when you look at hackers historically, sociologically, anthropologically, you see basically computer aficionados really, really dedicated to the craft of computing. And that's what a hacker is in a kind of very general sense.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because it changes the way you think about them. I think you're right. People say hacker and they think it's somebody who's trying to break in and make a mess of things.
Yep, cause some sort of malicious damage. And it's certainly the case that there is that type of hacking, and there's even kind of transgressive tradition in hacking, which is, I would say, illegal, but not necessarily criminal as well.
Now, you're an anthropologist, which means you're interested in the culture of hackers. Is that a fair statement?
Definitely, and especially their ethics and politics. That's what really drew me in more than anything else.
How'd you get interested? How did it start?
It started by learning about a license called the copyleft. It's really a class of licenses which really work in a very distinct way from copyright. Basically, they grant access to users to access, modify, and distribute software. And when I had learned that the copyleft had been invented by these free software hackers and was not only in use, but was what was being used on most of the internet, I was interested. I was surprised. I was like, okay, here are a bunch of technically minded computer folks who had basically reinvented the law. And that's when I delved in.
Now, you have actually gotten to know this firsthand. You spent, 3 years living with hackers in San Francisco?
Yep, 3 years. And I had done some research before and after as well online.
And this was just kind of when you were getting started with this. You had actually done some work on hackers for your academic studies. But this is kind of a different flavor, isn't it?
It is for anthropologists who have tended, especially if it's your first project, to leave your home country, go somewhere far away to do your initial research project. And I decided to, as I say, stay home. But I did find a very unfamiliar world to the one that I was used to.
I was going to say, you left your home country in the sense that these people, they're not completely different from everybody else you know. In fact, many of them may be people you know. But the culture is different from everyday society, isn't it?
No, that's precisely right. And it's interesting. It was a friend of mine who had kind of clued me into the copyleft, and I had known him for quite a long time. And he had sort of kept that not hidden as a secret, but he just didn't think I was necessarily interested in it. And it's definitely the case that what they do is not necessarily available or necessarily transparent to the rest of the world, although this was one of the interesting parts about my research is they're definitely committed to certain ideals like free speech, which do have broader currency.
In fact, in your book, Coding Freedom, you say at one point that the hacker world was the place where the culture of civil liberties was on fire. That's a pretty strong statement.
It is, and I stand by it still. I still see it well and live and kicking, and I think it really hit me at a certain point when about the 10th, 11th, 12th hacker was quoting Ben Franklin or Thomas Jefferson and then expanding on that to talk about the loss of civil liberties today. And that's really when I was like, okay, these folks are not simply building technology, but are really quite committed to certain strains of civil liberties in a very active way.
What's fascinating, I think, is to the outside world, people who know source code, who live inside computers, don't seem to be the kind of people who would care about the things that you've discovered the hacker community really does care about, this whole business of copyright and copyleft, of a consciousness of the legal implications of what they're doing. And in fact, you suggest that they may be more acutely conscious of the legal implications of free and open source software than than anybody else.
No, absolutely. And it's interesting because I make the argument that for many of them, they come to law and politics to protect their productive autonomy, their ability to exchange knowledge, share, build better technology. Over time, they come to care about broader issues that sometimes exceed just their technical craft. But what's so interesting as well is that I think their technical skills transfer over to the legal realm. So they become quite adept at reading the law, understanding the law, and making the law. That doesn't necessarily mean that they'd be good lawyers, because there's a lot of skills that are non-technical that go into being a good lawyer. But nonetheless, those very technical skills help us explain why they're so easily have been able to embrace the law and make that part and parcel of their craft today.
There is a kind of, I'm not sure exactly what to call it. There is a community that's living and breathing that isn't just numbers. Maybe that's what it is. But where it leads is to things that are not just technical efforts, but moral efforts. I was thinking about the Debian project. Tell me about the Debian project.
So Debian is a flavor of the Linux operating system, because Linux can come in different flavors. And it's currently a project of over 1,000 individuals located all over the world who work together to make sure that this operating system works and works well. And what's so fascinating about Debian is not simply that they are dispersed and can produce a high-quality product, it's just how complicated of an institution Debian is. They have a social contract and a constitution and guidelines and very complicated voting procedures. And this was also astounding to discover.
It's almost like the building of a country, isn't it? It was just a few people at the beginning, and before they let it grow, they established a moral basis on which it was allowed to grow.
Exactly. And there was moments that there was definite growing pains. And people said, okay, this is not working. What are we going to do about it? And it's, again, really kind of ironic, because a lot of these technical people, you know, if you ask them, they'd say, oh, we're not good at this social stuff, building a kind of organization. But in fact, those who decide to partake, because not everyone has to partake in the building of the organization, those that do have come up with very clever processes and procedures.
You've spent a lot of time writing about Anonymous, another organization of hackers, although maybe I'm wrong about that. Maybe it isn't just hackers. You even started writing a book about this. Isn't that right?
Yes, yes. And I'm so glad you mentioned that. I mean, what's so fascinating about Anonymous is precisely, on the one hand, hackers are essential to the building of what are different networks and different nodes and different groups sometimes who sit in a lot of tension with each other. They set up communication infrastructure, and they're the ones with the technical skills to engage in the hacking operations. Yet on the other hand, unlike a Debian, it truly is kind of open. Whoever wants to show up on the internet relay chat channels to contribute, whoever wants to call themselves anonymous can call themselves anonymous. So it has this extremely fluid, open, participatory dimension to it that some other hacker projects do not have.
Now, on the one hand, that would be great, of course. Everybody join. Come on. We're all together on this. On the other hand, it means you're sitting there and the name you use for yourself gets used by somebody with whom you may have serious disagreements.
Absolutely. And it's interesting because the different networks actually have distinct political cultures. So one of them, which protests the Church of Scientology, they no longer use something like a distributed denial of a service campaign, which is sending too many requests to a web page and it renders it inaccessible.
Yeah, there have been a lot in the news lately about efforts to bust up the daily operations, at least, of specified organizations.
Exactly. And other networks embrace this tactic as well. And then occasionally, there's an action in the name of Anonymous that then all the different networks go, we don't agree with that. You know, okay, someone can call themselves Anonymous, but it's pretty clear that it's a kind of lone individual acting.
In the book, you say that you think of Anonymous as both visible and invisible. Is that because some parts of it insist on staying hidden and some don't?
That's exactly it. I mean, it's fascinating. Anonymous is something that has landed on magazine covers. The mask has been taken up by rabble-rousers and protests all over the world. It's on CNN, Russia Today. It's just has this enormous visibility, keeps popping up in places you don't expect it, like a rape case in Steubenville, Ohio. You're like, what? On the other hand, for example, the largest Twitter account, Your Anonymous News, which is about to establish a kind of news site, has never granted one interview to the media. Who are these people? They're hard to access. Once they get arrested, they become unmasked. But otherwise, it can be quite difficult to really understand who they are and who they are behind the mask.
Gabriella Coleman is the author of Coding Freedom: The Ethics and Aesthetics of Hacking. Coming up, a true story of cyber stalking, as we conclude our hour on how the internet is changing our lives. I'm Tim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. James Lasden is the author of two acclaimed novels and several collections of short stories and poetry. His new book is a memoir he wishes he never had to write. It's about the cyberbullying he experienced at the hands of a former student. Here's James Lasden reading from his book, Give Me Everything You Have, on being stalked.
The question of reputation, to the extent that it had ever interested me before this episode, had done so for purely literary or antiquarian reasons. It belonged, I assumed, to a bygone world where communications were imperfect and social arrangements consequently more dependent on trust and hearsay than they are now. In the past, your name, what other people could report about you, was crucial to your survival, whether you were a medieval knight or an Elizabethan merchant or a Victorian governess. A stain on your honor was potentially catastrophic, and so you guarded it jealously and defended it, if necessary, with your life. In our own time, with more efficient information systems at our disposal, we were no longer, I supposed, so much at the mercy of other people's perceptions or opinions. Facts could be checked, rumors and falsehoods refuted. A phone or a plane could bring you into direct contact with a potential business partner or employer. Reputation still meant something, but it no longer meant everything, and no longer required the implied threat of pistols at dawn to underwrite it, or suicide to purge its loss. The insane dueling culture of the past, fights to the death over obscure points of musical criticism, demotion to the ranks for failing to resent an insult, had become obsolete and was fast becoming incomprehensible. People could relax, finally, from the state of coiled-up vigilance in which those who wished to get on in the world had spent their lives for so many centuries. And yet it seems that sometime near the end of the 20th century, by a curious quirk of scientific progress, history in this regard reversed course. The internet emerged, and with it, the arbitration of reality began to pass back from the realm of verifiable fact to that of rumor and report, from the actual to the virtual. The latter, an indiscriminate tumult of truth and lies, was the zone in which our public identities, our outer selves, once again began to assume their definitive form. There was the private self still, but for anyone who interacted with the world, there was this strange new emanation of yourself, your internet presence, and it was by this, increasingly, that others knew you and judged you. Very quickly, it was discovered that you could manipulate it, glamorize your image, finesse your biography. And by the same token, you could manipulate other people's presences, boost an ally's standing, or launch a corrosive lie against an enemy. One would think that the ease of performing such manipulations, and the large scale on which they immediately began occurring, would have long ago discredited the web as a source of information about anything. But although we all acknowledge the need to be cautious, to discount much of what we read, split the difference between conflicting statements and so on, our first instinct, being creatures of the word, is to trust it, And even on deeper consideration, we tend to feel that it is basically more right than wrong, and that we can accept its approximations as the truth. You are what the web says you are, and if it misrepresents you, the feeling of outrage, anguish, of having been violated in some elemental layer of your existence is, as I began to learn, peculiarly crushing.
James Lasden, reading from his book Give Me Everything You Have, on being stalked. As Lasden tells Steve Paulson, the email exchanges with his former student, whom he calls Nazreen, started out innocently enough.
But at a certain point, it became clear that she was expecting this to lead to an affair, and I made it clear that I was happily married. And again, that was fine. She seemed to take it very, very graciously. And I could actually read you some of an email that she sent at that time when I told her this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not used to having men lend me support, help, or friendship without any sort of amorous or sexual intentions. I didn't really think that's where you were taking this very benign relationship of ours. So it seemed fine. We continued to correspond. But at a certain point, it became clear to me that actually it wasn't all okay and that she was getting obsessed and her emails grew. What happened was that there just were more and more of them, and I started answering fewer and fewer of them. And at a certain point, I realized that I was becoming the object of an obsession.
Did you tell her or did you ask her to back off?
Yes, I did. And she kept saying that, I must leave you alone, I must stop this. And I kept waiting for her to do that. I thought, she'll ease up and then we'll, you know, maybe we'll be able to sort of be in touch again. I didn't make a conscious decision that I wasn't going to write back to her. There was never any gap between her emails, and I felt at a certain point that it wouldn't be a good idea to write back to her.
So when you said that she was sending you a lot of emails, how many?
There were several a day. I mean, it varied, but this was over many months. In January of 2007, I went with my wife and two kids to France to do a guidebook. And we were away for 4 months, and we were staying in farmhouses that didn't have internet connection. So I'd only get my email once every few days. And every time I logged on, there'd be 20, 30, 40 emails from her. By now, I was disturbed by it, but I was also very busy with this guidebook, and there wasn't much I could do about it. I read some of the emails. They seemed sort of harmless in themselves, but the quantity of them was what was disturbing at that point. And then we got back in June of 2007 or July, and almost overnight, suddenly one day, well, it was overnight, actually, she suddenly turned from these fairly innocuous emails to vitriolic hate mail and accusations, first of all, that I'd plagiarized her work in a story of mine, later accusations of sexual misconduct. Then she began widening her target to include my agent and this editor she had worked with. We were all, according to her, part of a Jewish conspiracy to steal her work and sell it to other American writers of Iranian descent. And she started sending violently anti-Semitic emails to the three of us, as well as everything else.
And she actually called what she was doing verbal terrorism, which seems like a pretty good description.
Well, she had a way with words. And I had never come across that phrase before. I don't know if she invented it, but she had a sort of pithy turn of phrase. And I think it was very accurate, too. Words were her weapon. And she was conducting, I think, from her point of view, asymmetric warfare. I mean, she regarded herself as somebody very powerless, and me particularly as somebody powerful, a published author, with something to lose, and she, I think, felt she had nothing to lose. Where the anti-Semitism came from, I do not know. I mean, there was no sign of it before. The book is very much an attempt to understand what happened, what was going on with her, what I brought to the situation.
Why do you think Nazreen was so obsessed with you? I mean, she was fixated on you, I mean, to the point where she was doing everything she could to try to smear you. I mean, she must have spent hours and hours and hours trying to construct this campaign against you.
Well, it is a mystery. She conducted a pretty methodical, systematic smear campaign. She began posting things on websites about me, these various allegations. She escalated to physical threats and things. But the question of why, it's very hard to answer, but in the process of writing the book, one of the things that I thought about, that I hadn't really thought about at the time, was the possible impact of my having fallen silent. I think it was possibly more upsetting, more disturbing to her than I realized at the time. As I said, I didn't take this deliberate decision, I am no longer going to respond to these emails. But that is what happened. And perhaps that was traumatic in some way. But I don't think it accounts for 5 years of unrelenting hate mail and threats and identity theft and all the rest of the stuff she did. And I I think there's a part of the picture that is to do with personality disorder, some kind of imbalance, although I'm not qualified to make a diagnosis, and I only half believe in the categories of personality disorder.
This is very much a story of the internet age. I mean, what she was able to do, I mean, spread these emails not just to you but to lots of people you knew, to start posting on websites where you had been published. And I guess one of the sobering lessons of all of this is it's quite easy to spread malicious gossip, and it's not at all easy to figure out how to counteract that.
That's one of the things the internet brings with it. It's this amazing new medium, this amazing new technology. But it does facilitate new forms of harm as well, I think. And I think it may possibly have brought into being a new kind of stalker, somebody who might not have done this kind of thing before. I think it allows people who think of themselves or who are powerless in the real world to be very powerful. It's very easy to put malice out there and to have it spread far and wide and to do quite a bit of damage to people in ways that might not have been possible before. I mean, there were stalkers before, of course, but I think somebody who does cyber stalking might not be a physical stalker. They might not want to expose themselves to that kind of danger. I even think phone stalking is a slightly different thing because there's a filter, I suppose, that happens when you're brought into speech that might inhibit some people. Whereas the internet, email, online postings is a very direct, it's almost as if your unconscious is expressing itself directly. It's almost like telepathy. You can just send out these impulses of hatred or whatever, and there's no kind of inhibiting filter between you and the recipient. So I think for people who are very impulsive and are swayed by incredibly powerful feelings that they can't control, it offers a kind of irresistible form of expression.
James Lasden is the author of Give Me Everything You Have, On Being Stalked. He spoke with Steve Paulson. Lasden told Steve he hasn't heard from Nesreen since August 2012. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of the program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the program, The Internet. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Ann Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, and Sarah Nix. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.